This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. Newslink.
Hello, welcome to Newslink. I'm Matt Herman in Bonn, Germany. Coming up on the program, we'll bring you the latest from Libya and across Europe as we all digest the news of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi's death. We'll tell you about the mounting anticipation leading up to the Eurozone crisis summit this weekend. Germany and France are said to have a plan. And we'll hear how elections in Spain, which conservatives are all but sure to win, may affect the future of the country's autonomous regions.
This will put Catalan self-government and Catalan institutions and also Catalan language and Catalan culture a little bit in an uncomfortable situation.
All that and more coming up on Newslink, on Deutsche Welle Radio, Germany's international broadcaster. Let's get started. First to North Africa. The man who ruled Libya with a dictatorial grip for 42 years until he was ousted by rebels in a civil war, Muammar Gaddafi, was killed on Thursday when revolutionary forces overwhelmed his hometown of Sirte. After hours of rumor and uncertainty, his death was officially confirmed by the Libyan Prime Minister, Mahmoud Jibril. Our reporter Gabriel Borud has been following the day's dramatic developments.
The first sounds of celebration on Thursday were heard on the streets of Sirte. They came from rebel fighters shouting and shooting guns in triumph that Gaddafi had been captured. Then reports surfaced that Gaddafi had been killed while being captured outside of Sirte. Muammar Gaddafi is dead, said rebel military chief Abdel Hakim Belhaj in Tripoli. This is the beginning of a new Libya. An end to despotism, an end to autocracy, an end to Gaddafi, and the beginning of democracy. The news was eventually made official by Libyan Prime Minister Mahmoud Jibril in a statement from Benghazi, which was confirmed in London by Ambassador Mahmoud Nakua.
A black era has come to an end. The Libyan freedom fighters have finally succeeded in drawing the curtain on Gaddafi's crimes.
United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon welcomed the news of Gaddafi's passing from New York, but called on Libya's new government to make the transition to democracy.
Now is the time for all Libyans to come together. Libyans can only realize the promise of the future through national unity and reconciliation.
Germany's foreign minister, Guido Westerwelle, echoed those sentiments from Berlin.
Muammar Gaddafi was a dictator who waged war on his own people. Germany is on the side of the new Libya, on its path to a better, peaceful and democratic future.
Gaddafi led Libya with an iron fist for decades and, up to a few months ago, thought his people would be willing to die for him.
They love me, all my people with me. They love me, all. They will die to protect me, my people.
Gaddafi's rule came to an end in August when he was ousted by rebel forces from Tripoli. He then fled to Sirte, one of the remaining strongholds, and Gaddafi's hometown and birthplace. The National Transitional Council had said it was waiting for the fall of Sirte to declare the liberation of all of Libya. Now, amid confirmed reports of Gaddafi's death, that day has come. Libya is ready to embrace a new era. Gabriel Borud, Deutsche Welle Radio.
Gaddafi is history. What will that new era look like? What happens next? I put that question to Thomas Hasel, who researches totalitarianism in North Africa at Berlin's Free University.
Until now, everyone in Libya was worried as long as Gaddafi was still not found. Which power does he still have to do harm to, the changes in Libya? Was worried that if he fled, he had power by his money, by his wealth, to still attack Libyan interests. And now this worry is gone somehow, and that's the reason, I think, why a lot of Libyans now are celebrating in the streets.
Is NATO now going to just pull out of Libya and leave the NTC to its own devices?
I can't imagine that NATO is just pulling out. the reason why NATO participated in this campaign and supported the rebel fighters against Gaddafi was not only human rights or democracy, etc., etc. It has also interest in stability and in economical ties, etc., etc. And so the NATO will go on playing some role, maybe more in a covert way, in trying to find weapons, for example, to secure a certain stabilization of the country. And I can very well imagine that France, the US, and Great Britain, for example, will try to influence the political developments in a way that no two radical, two anti-Western powers would come to power in Libya, which is still a probability or a possibility.
Can you expand on that just for a moment? Because it would seem to me that the representatives of the Libyan rebels that we have come to know so far, the National Transitional Council, are certainly not of the doctrinaire anti-Western variety. What other faction do you think could rise into a powerful role?
I think that it is very important for NATO or for Europe and the USA to have people in Libya in power that are pro-Western and that give Western powers and the Western economy influence in the Libyan market, so mainly the oil sector. There is a probability or a possibility that, well, more Islamist powers in Libya and the future Libyan government have something to say. So I can imagine that the Western governments would try to influence the new government in a way that it stays pro-Western. For example, the military chief of Tripolis, Abdel Hakim Belhaj, he is a known Islamist. He seems to be more and more powerful. And he was somebody who was brought by CIA to Libya, where he was tortured then after 2004. And so this man, for example, I could imagine, has some kind of bad feelings about the West in Libya. And so this will be a very important phase where the West would try to influence the developments in a positive way for itself.
Thomas Hasel of Berlin's Free University. In Brussels, the death of Colonel Gaddafi has been hailed as the end of a brutal and bloody era of repression in Libya. As Vanessa Mock reports, the European Union has promised to support Libya through its transition to what is hoped will be a peaceful and democratic future.
The news of Gaddafi's death has been greeted here in Brussels with unreserved relief. Speaking just as the news was confirmed, the European Commission President José Manuel Barroso said he hoped Libyans would now be able to move on from a bloody chapter in their shared history.
What we can say is that this marks an era, the end of an era of despotism. And I believe it was about time to come to an end to this era because the Libyan people have suffered for too long. So what I hope now is that today's people of Libya can embrace freedom, building a new democratic future.
The EU was among the first to recognize the new authorities in Libya, and it's already donated 150 million in direct aid to the country. Michael Mann, the spokesman for the EU's High Representative Catherine Ashton, said Europe would continue its commitment to rebuilding the country.
We are part of the Friends of Libya group. And we have been tasked with a number of things to help with the future rebuilding of Libya. We're looking into communication, we're looking into women's rights, we're looking into helping civil society groups, we're looking into security sector reform.
But privately there are also concerns about where Libya is headed. Diplomats have been concerned about some of the reported abuses committed by the new leadership and questioning whether they were up to the job of rebuilding the fabric of this divided country. Jerzy Buzek heads up the European Parliament and is headed to Libya on Saturday.
Today marks a new impetus towards democratic change through the creation of an interim government. The transition must be inclusive and pave the way for political pluralism. The new democratic system must be based on the rule of law and respect for fundamental rights of all citizens.
Down at the road at NATO headquarters, officials said they were unsure if one of their airplanes had killed Gaddafi, but they said that his death would now bring an end to their current operations in the country. The alliance has been in Libya since the end of March in a mission led by Britain and France. Operations, though, have divided its members and drained the military budgets of those who've taken part in it. And the alliance has made clear it will pull out just as soon as it gets the signal from the new authorities. Vanessa Mock, Deutsche Welle Radio, Brussels.
Around the world, around the clock, news and information from the heart of Europe on Deutsche Welle Radio, DWTV, and online too at dwworld.de. This is Newslink. My name is Matt Herman. Next to the Eurozone debt crisis, you didn't think we'd skip a day of talking about that, did you? There are hopes that this weekend's three-day marathon of meetings involving finance and foreign ministers, as well as heads of government and state, will lead to an agreement on beefing up the Eurozone Rescue Fund and on the recapitalization of banks under threat. German Finance Minister Wolfgang Schäuble has said France and Germany had agreed on a common position. He didn't elaborate. In Berlin, Hardy Grautner looks at what that position might be.
The Eurozone's Rescue Fund currently comprises 440 billion euros in state guarantees, of which Germany shoulders 211 billion euros. It was a tough job getting German taxpayers to accept that figure, and it would be next to impossible to persuade them to accept an even larger one. But it has become apparent in the meantime the rescue fund, in its present size, would be too small to bail out Greece, let alone come to the aid of other struggling Eurozone countries as well. That's why Eurozone leaders have been racking their brains over how to use the fund more effectively and to enlarge it without having to scale up the guarantees underwritten by individual Eurozone states. The buzzword is leverage. Countries in trouble would essentially use the rescue fund to purchase insurance on a percentage of their newly issued government bonds. That would make those securities more attractive to investors. Underwriting the first 20 or 30% of any losses, the fund would effectively be multiplied in size 3 or even 5 times, and it wouldn't increase the burden on the taxpayer. That's the most important point, says German Finance Minister Wolfgang Schäuble. Many would still interpret a leverage mechanism as something that would automatically increase our liabilities in a worst-case scenario, he said. But we don't subscribe to such an interpretation, because if it were true, we wouldn't be able to push it through Parliament. Schäuble also listed guaranteeing a percentage of government bond issues and raising private sector liabilities as an option for increasing the impact of the rescue fund. He has the backing of Conservative Budget Affairs spokesman Stefan Müller. Not all theoretically possible ways of lending more firepower to the rescue fund would entail a greater risk for the individual states and an ensuing loss to the taxpayer, he said. For us, it's clear that Germany must not be asked to guarantee more than the 211 billion euros that we previously endorsed within the framework of the second Eurozone bailout scheme. And from all we've seen so far, it's realistic to assume that that can be taken care of. Underwriting the percentage value of newly issued government bonds should have the desired effect of bringing down the yields on such securities. While opposition Green Party MP Gerhard Schick sees the benefit of such a measure, he insists that the National Parliament would have to approve such a move in advance. Leading figures in the coalition government have been telling us for weeks on end that there shouldn't be any kind of leverage, he said. So now that there's been a change of plan, we parliamentarians and the public have the right to know what exactly is behind this change in strategy. I believe that the National Parliament will have to approve any leverage-related measures before they go into effect. I'm not suggesting we would vote against them. We do understand the urgency of the situation ahead of the summit in Brussels at the weekend. Germany's economics minister, Philipp Rösler, is well aware that the Eurozone crisis will have an adverse impact on German exports to other Eurozone countries. On Thursday, the minister slashed the government's forecast for growth in 2012 by nearly half, from 1.8% as predicted in April to a meager 1%. Hardy Graupner, Deutsche Welle Radio, Berlin.
Perspectives on the news, a uniquely European point of view. You're tuned to Newslink on Deutsche Welle Radio from Bonn, Germany.
And now to Italy, As pressure mounts on Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi to propose measures to stimulate the sluggish Italian economy, the leader seems paralyzed by a fractious coalition. The country's president, Giorgio Napolitano, has spoken out, urging Berlusconi to show leadership and responsibility. From Rome, Megan Williams reports.
L'Italia è molto esposta ai venti di questa crisi.
Italian President Giorgio Napolitano said he was anguished about Italy's stagnant economy and the government's inability to take action that might stimulate growth. I cannot keep quiet about my anguish at seeing that the political conditions for this wide consensus to take responsibility for the economy have not yet occurred, he said. As Napolitano expressed his concerns at a public gathering, Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi was caught on camera asleep in the audience. Critics say it's just one more sign of a leader overwhelmed by Italy's problems and out of his depth when it comes to solving them. Despite growing pressure from Italy's largest business group, Confindustria, and the European Central Bank, Berlusconi has so far failed to come up with proposals to stimulate growth for an economy that's been slow since he first came into power a decade ago.
The problems with Italy right now has been this expectation that in the long run that is not going to be sustainable. So the reaction instead has been trying to fix the short-run problem, but really it's a long-run problem, and so you have to address the long-run problem.
Economist Giuseppe Ragusa at the Lewis University in Rome says the government's failure to bring about reform exposes Italian bonds to even more speculation, making its debt even harder to pay off. What Italians and investors are looking for, says Ragusa, is deep reform.
To make Italy grow, you have to do reforms, implement reform, the education system, labor system, expenditure infrastructure, increase the productivity and efficiency of firms. And, of course, one of the big problem in Italy is tax evasion. By reducing tax evasion, you can decrease taxes on the people who pay taxes and make the system more efficient.
But so far, Italy's government has only managed to pass an austerity package with cuts to public spending and tax hikes, which many say will only further stall the economy. Government infighting has also led to procrastination in naming a successor to the head of the Bank of Italy. The current governor, Mario Draghi, is leaving to head up the European Central Bank. Megan Williams, Deutsche Welle Radio, Rome.
Perspectives on the news. A European point of view. You're listening to Newslink here on Deutsche Welle Radio. I'm your host, Matt Herman, in Bonn. 1 month from today, Spain will be electing a new parliament. The vote is taking place a few months earlier than it had to, triggered as it was by palpable dissatisfaction with the ruling Socialist Party's handling of the economic crisis. But in the autonomous community of Catalonia, the politics are a bit more complicated. As Andrew Bowen reports from Barcelona, the economic crisis there has had a radicalizing effect.
It's mid-morning at Barcelona's La Rambla, a long and wide pedestrian street that's one of the city's biggest tourist attractions. And among the shops and newsstands selling postcards and tacky souvenirs is a growing number of stores not aimed at tourists. They all pretty much look the same. Big yellow signs outside that say in bold black letters, Compro Oro. I buy gold. Armando Álvarez owns a number of these kinds of shops across Barcelona. He says since the start of the financial crisis, buying and selling gold has become a big business.
For example, before in Barcelona there were maybe 30 shops that bought and sold gold, and now it's multiplied by more than 10, something like 400 shops across the city.
The boom of the gold trade is a very visible sign of how bad the crisis has gotten in Spain, and it's especially shameful for the autonomous community of Catalonia, which historically has been one of the most prosperous regions in the country. In the run-up to the elections on November 20th, the financial crisis is on everyone's minds, and it's leading to the all but certain defeat of the socialists and the victory of the conservative People's Party. But because the socialists have traditionally been more supportive of Catalan interests, they're still likely to win in Catalonia, despite much dissatisfaction among voters.
I'm going to vote for the socialists because the right doesn't do anything but rob. The socialist government has had the misfortune of being in office when the financial crisis came, not just in Spain, but in all of Europe.
I'm obviously going to vote for the Socialist Party. The People's Party doesn't offer me anything. All they want to do is cut social programs. And in these times, I don't think welfare cuts are the most important thing in this country. On the contrary.
The election isn't for another month. I honestly don't know which party I'll vote for yet. I'm still undecided. Because everyone promises and promises, and once they're in office, they disappoint you.
For almost 10 years, I haven't voted for any party. No candidate or party represents me. I'm just really disappointed with all of them. The right does scare me a bit, but for now, I think we at least need a change.
With their own distinct language and culture, most Catalans see their homeland as a separate nation which deserves more autonomy. Currently, the region sends its own tax revenues to Madrid, which then disperses it across the rest of the country. And the money Catalonia gets back is significantly less than what it gives.
This is considered unfair by many, many Catalan citizens.
That's Ferran Requejo, political scientist at Pompeu Fabra University.
More than 75% of Catalan citizens wants to review, to change this unfair balance, which is not very usual in any of the decentralized or federal countries.
Requejo says the financial crisis has led to a merging of the two most important issues in this election for Catalan voters, the economy and Catalonia's autonomy. The tax money the region loses to Madrid has contributed to a rise in Catalan nationalism. At a time when Catalonia is struggling with its own deficit, many see no reason why they should be giving so much of their own money away.
The central government doesn't answer according to the Catalan needs, and this reinforces even the secessionist attitude of the Catalan, the average Catalan voter.
But for those Catalan nationalists, things don't look great ahead of the elections. The People's Party has historically opposed giving more power over to the autonomous communities. And with a government led by them,
this will put Catalan self-government and Catalan institutions and also Catalan language and Catalan culture a little bit in an uncomfortable situation.
Gaspar Perigay is editor-in-chief of the English language Catalan news agency.
Catalan nationalism is very strong in the late years, but Spanish nationalism is also very strong in the late years. And you could say that there is a polarization of the two nationalism going to different directions or colliding directions. It depends on how pessimistic you are about the vision.
The socialists have lost considerable support in Catalonia, both to the People's Party and the center-right Catalan Nationalist Party, Convergence and Union. The big question on many voters' minds is whether the People's Party will get an absolute majority, or if the Catalan nationalists will become the kingmakers. And if that comes true, Catalan autonomy will become a national issue. Andrew Bowen, Deutsche Welle Radio, Barcelona.
For more news and information from the heart of Europe, do visit our website. It's dwworld.de. There you'll find podcasts of this and many other Deutsche Welle Radio programs. With a uniquely European perspective on the events of the day, you're listening to Newslink here on Deutsche Welle Radio, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm your host, Matt Herman. You're listening to Deutsche Welle Radio's Newslink. I'm Matt Herman. Coming up on the next 30 minutes of Newslink, NATO peacekeepers find themselves in the middle of a three-way balancing act as they dismantle barriers built by ethnic Serbs in the north of Kosovo.
The north has been a traditional flashpoint. It is a part of Kosovo's territory that is not controlled by the Kosovan government. And while it's sort of under the control of Serbia, it's actually mainly under the control of kind of criminal gangs and groups that operate there because there's a sort of power vacuum.
We'll have that story in a few minutes, but first, Turkey has widened its military incursion into neighboring northern Iraq. The operation, which started on Wednesday, came in response to the killing of 24 Turkish soldiers in attacks by Kurdish PKK rebels based across the Iraqi border. Outrage over the killings within the Turkish public continues to grow, as Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Death to the PKK, hundreds of people chant as they march down Istanbul's main high street. There is a sense of enough is enough among the demonstrators following Wednesday's killing by the PKK of 24 soldiers, as this man explains. The PKK are evil, he said. We are here to support our 24 martyrs. They will never divide Turkey. You can never kill enough of them. Similar protests against the PKK are occurring across the country. Wednesday's attack by the rebel group was the deadliest since 1993 and has shocked the country. Many houses and shops have raised the Turkish flag as anger begets a wave of nationalism that is being fueled by continuous news coverage of Turkey's ongoing military incursion into neighboring northern Iraq. Initially aimed at tracking down the Kurdish rebels who carried out Wednesday's attack, the Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan indicated the operation is taking on a far broader character. This operation is part of a solution to terrorism, he told reporters. As a Turkish Republic, we are determined to tackle this issue. The Turkish Armed Forces say 22 battalions are involved in the incursion. Experts say that that could mean between 10 and 15,000 soldiers may now be in Iraqi territory, making it Turkey's largest incursion into Iraq since 2008. Nechivan Barzani, the deputy head of the ruling Kurdish Democratic Party, which controls Iraqi Kurdistan, where the incursion is taking place, flew to Ankara for talks. He pledged to cooperate with Turkey. But as the incursion continues to grow, a veteran of previous operations into Iraq, retired Brigadier General Haldan Solmaztürk, warns of their limited effect.
The small-scale operation, focusing mainly on PKK elements, would achieve, above all, a psychological effect that would carry the message to the PKK. Northern Iraq is not a safe haven, but honestly, the existence of PKK elements in a couple of camps in northern Iraq are just small extensions of the major problem inside Turkey.
But the Turkish government, keen to assuage the public outrage over the PKK attacks, appears keen on pursuing a military solution to the nearly three-decade-long conflict. Political scientist Cengiz Aktar says along with anger, there is a sense of fatigue among the people over the seemingly endless conflict.
There is a general fed-up in the Turkish public opinion, and everyone, including those voices who are not necessarily pro-Kurdish, are now calling for peaceful solutions. The whole question is who is capable of going back to the negotiation table, and we will see in the probably quite shortly whether that will happen or not.
That seems unlikely, with the Turkish Prime Minister not only attacking the PKK, but also the country's main legal Kurdish party, accusing them of giving a voice to the terrorist campaign. 60 more of its members were detained Thursday, adding to the current 4,000 already jailed since 2009. Dorian Jones, Deutsche Welle Radio, Istanbul.
NATO-led peacekeeping troops in northern Kosovo began dismantling roadblocks erected by Kosovan Serbs near a disputed border crossing with Serbia. There's been a three-month standoff between NATO troops and Kosovo Serbs since Serbs erected some 20 barricades in protest at efforts by the Pristina government to assert control over the region. I asked our correspondent in Belgrade, Mark Lowen, to set the scene for us.
quite a lot of trouble, really, at the barricades in the north. The worst trouble in northern Kosovo for several months. The NATO peacekeepers went up to the barricades at 6 o'clock this morning, local time, and they tried to disperse the Serbs who were manning the barricades, who've been manning the barricades for several weeks. They used tear gas at one barricade to disperse crowds of protesters. There were 8 injuries among NATO peacekeepers. 8 of them were lightly injured by tear gas canisters. And it is now, I've just spoken to the NATO spokesman in Kosovo, he says that it is now under control. The Serbs resisted, they tried to regroup, but it looks like NATO is now taking control of the situation there. They are pushing up towards the northern border with Serbia, the disputed border, and they are trying to take control of more of the makeshift barriers that have been in place for several weeks there. The Serbian president issued a call for restraint from both sides, from the Serbs and from the international community. He said that violence must be avoided at all costs.
Was there any direct involvement from the Kosovo national government in this action? This is, at least in part, about Pristina regaining control of its territory, right?
It is about that. The Kosovan government has never really controlled the north. The north is populated mainly by ethnic Serbs who were vehemently against Kosovo's declaration of independence from Serbia. And so since that secession back in 2008, the north has remained largely lawless, not under the control of the Kosovan government. So it has very much supported the actions of NATO and the international community in trying to clear the Serb barricades in the north. But the Kosovan government has not directly sent its forces to take part in those actions, because that would very much be fanning the flames of a very volatile area. The trouble started in the north when the Kosovan government did send its police officers to the northern border back in July, leading to clashes with the Serbs, in which one Kosovan policeman was killed. And so the Kosovan government has very much learnt its lesson, I think, that if it tries to send its forces into the north, that will spark trouble. So it has stayed back in the Kosovan capital, in Pristina, watching everything and tacitly or actually vocally supporting the operation. But it is very much hoping that that NATO will do the actions for it, that NATO will clear the barricades and try to take control of the lawless north, so that some kind of long-term solution for the north can be hammered out in dialogue. But that really is some way away, I think, shown by the clashes today.
What is your sense about NATO's stomach for actions like this going forward? I mean, they're here ostensibly to keep a peace, not to be at the front lines of any kind of conflict, no matter how small scale.
That's right, and they have tried to reduce their forces over the last few years. I mean, they have reduced it. And back in 1999, when NATO entered Kosovo, there were 50,000 NATO peacekeepers. Today, there are just over 5,000. They wanted to cut that number down even more this year, but with this crisis in the north, I think they've realised that they are still needed. And so they have not reduced the number anymore. But they don't have the stomach for a major escalation there in the north. I mean, the north has been a traditional flashpoint. It is a part of Kosovo's territory that is not controlled by the Kosovan government, but and while it's sort of under the control of Serbia, it's actually mainly under the control of kind of criminal gangs and groups that operate there, because there's a sort of power vacuum. NATO does patrol there fairly freely, usually. They want to be able to have access to the border, to control there in the north, but they will try to prevent any kind of major escalation of the violence.
Mark Lowen in Belgrade. You're listening to Newslink here on Deutsche Welle Radio. My name is Matt Herman. Investigators across the EU have discovered that con men have exploited the recently created European CO2 market to steal a total of some 5 billion euros. Yes, I said billion. That would make it the most costly case of fraud in European history. In Paris, John Lawrenson has the story.
It is the great European CO2 swindle, a simple though ingenious scheme to steal huge amounts of money, and this is how it worked. In 2005, the EU set up a CO2 market. The idea was to force companies to pay for the right to emit CO2 into the atmosphere. If a car maker, for example, was going to put 10,000 tons of carbon dioxide into the air, he had to buy the equivalent quantity on the CO2 market. But there was a flaw in the system. Some countries charged sales tax on that carbon. Other countries charged no tax at all. So what this gang of financial rip-off artists did was to set up trading companies in Israel and Cyprus, which were in fact nothing but front companies. First, they used them to buy hundreds of thousands of euros of CO2 quotas in zero VAT countries such as the UK. Then they sold this carbon to companies in countries such as France, adding the statutory 19.6% VAT to the bill. And of course, once they received their money, they didn't give it to the French taxman. They disappeared with their loot. They pulled off what is believed to be the biggest con in French history. One of these criminals, currently under investigation in France, agreed to speak to France Info Radio on condition that they didn't divulge his name and they changed his voice. He explained what attracted him to the carbon market.
L'argent, le gain. On va dire de l'argent facile et surtout qui était le marché était fait d'une sorte que on pouvait pas perdre son argent, on pouvait pas se le faire voler.
Money, financial gain, easy money, shall we say. Also, the market was structured in such a way that you couldn't lose money or have it stolen. It wasn't a real financial market, so there was no real risk of losing the money you invested. There was no merchandise to move around. Logistically, it required almost nothing, just a computer and a telephone. It couldn't have been simpler. As for being conscious that this represented such a large loss for the government, yes, I saw the sums of money involved and realized it was coming out of someone's pocket. Personally, I was conscious of this. This illicit business got so big, so quickly, that it attracted into the relatively well-behaved world of white-collar crime, organized criminals of a rougher sort, who, in time-honored mafia tradition, offered their protection. Two men were shot dead in Paris this month, apparently mafia killings linked to CO2 trading. It's all a rather long way away from ecology. Frédéric Ploquin, organized crime expert with the news weekly Marianne, explains how things got out of hand.
Les gens qui se sont lancés là-dedans se sont fait assez vite repérer parce qu'en fait on a vu des hommes s'enrichir à vitesse grand V.
The people who got involved in that market got themselves noticed very quickly, Ploquin says, because in the space of a summer they became extremely rich. The word went round through the nightclubs and discotheques. Did you see so and so? He's just made a fortune. And the word CO2 started coming out of the mouths of these gangsters as if it was the goose that laid the golden eggs. The problem in the end was that this con was just generating too much money.
Il y avait probablement trop d'argent.
So far, 15 people have been arrested following a six-month investigation. Several others are still on the run, apparently in Israel. And the carbon market has been secured, making it impossible, in theory at least, to operate the same con today in France. In Italy, however, a law securing the carbon market still hasn't come before Parliament. John Lawrenson, Deutsche Welle Radio, Paris.
Now to Britain, an emissions issue you might have had a bit more contact with. The head of International Airlines, the group that owns British Airways and Spanish carrier Iberia, is accusing the government of inflicting significant damage on the aviation industry with its emissions tax. Company CEO Willie Walsh claims that the higher flight prices that the tax brought saw UK airports lose more than 7 million passengers last year. Now, as the European Union moves closer to including airlines in its carbon trading scheme starting January 1st, airlines want the British national levy scrapped. Nick Martin reports from London.
It's not the first time Willie Walsh has hit out about the air passenger duty, or APD.
I think these taxes are a disgrace. I've made my views known publicly. I see no justification for levying these very high levels of taxation on families and on businesses who want to travel.
This is a final call for passengers.
Over the summer, Walsh accepted that high fuel prices and APD meant that the era of cheap flights was over. And just this week, at a travel conference in Mallorca, Walsh made his strongest call yet for the passenger duty to be abolished. He called on transport officials to carry out a full study on the effect the flying poll tax, as he called it, was having on the British economy. Simon Buck is the chief executive of the British Air Transport Association, which represents the 10 leading UK airlines.
He explains just how much the duty adds to the cost of tickets.
The tax that can apply on a UK ticket to depart the UK can be as much as £150 on a long-haul flight. That's extremely expensive for an individual. If it's a family of four, you can see how it quickly mounts up. This is far, far more than the actual cost of the emissions produced by aviation. So we think that tax is wrong. We think that tax is far too heavy. It's far more than the government collects from the tax on the banks, for example. Why is the UK aviation consumer being singled out for punishment in this way?
British Airways, American Airlines and Iberia to New York JFK.
APD was introduced at £5 per short haul and £10 per long haul journey in 1994. The tax has risen dramatically in the last 4 years. In November, it increased by up to 55%. Airline representatives say the UK's top rate of air passenger duty is more than 8 times the average of those EU countries which still levy a charge. The Netherlands scrapped their version of the APD after a government report found it was bringing in much less money than expected. One figure suggested the tax cost the Dutch economy 4 times more than the revenue it brought in. Since then, Amsterdam Schiphol Airport has seen passenger numbers increase again. What's more, Brussels is about to introduce an emission trading scheme, which Buck thinks is a preferable way to tax flights.
We think that the air passenger duty, which has been in place since 1994, should be reduced when we have a new European way of accounting for aircraft emissions, which applies from the 1st of January next year. We maintain that the new European way of doing this is the fairest way to do that and the least way that would cause the least competitive distortion between airlines that are both UK-based and foreign-based.
But worse still for travellers, the British government intends to increase the APD in April next year and has said it wants to raise an extra 40% of revenue from air travel duties by 2015. Many of Britain's traditional travel agents, the few that are left, are being squeezed further. Not only have budget carriers and the internet made many of them redundant, the increased cost of fuel is putting off many British travellers from flying at all. Ajay Soda runs a specialist agency serving the charitable sector. He says that many of the increases are just starting to be noticed.
Certainly early days to be able to tell how much of an impact it's having. We've been looking at our data, and because most of the increase in price has been in the last 3 to 4 months, I have a feeling that budget holders will start getting a bit jumpy soon. They may have to cut back on the amount of travel they can do.
British Airways, American Airlines, and
for BA's boss, the problem is that the UK doesn't have a clear aviation or tourism strategy. Walsh thinks other European air hubs are benefiting at Britain's expense. He's accused Chancellor George Osborne of being too obsessed with bringing down the deficit in the UK's public finances. Another effect is the impact increased ticket prices are having on many of Britain's regional airports. Industry spokesman Simon Buck thinks many could be set to lose valuable services.
Well, I think airlines are looking very carefully at what is an economic and a viable route to operate. And I think the big problem is that many of the thinner routes, perhaps operated from regional airports, may be the ones which will be subject to the greatest scrutiny. Many regional airports are big drivers of their local economies, and if we see local airports losing services, then it's less likely to attract new business to that region.
Walsh, meanwhile, warns that if the government doesn't reverse its policies, the UK will continue to lose out as the rest of the world grows their aviation industries. Nick Martin, Deutsche Welle Radio, London.
News and information from the heart of Europe. Newslink on Deutsche Welle Radio, Germany's international broadcaster.
I'm your host, Matt Herman. The Jenin Freedom Theater in the Palestinian West Bank takes young people and trains them to professional standards in acting, directing, lighting, and set construction. In April this year, it experienced tragedy. Its founder, Palestinian-Israeli actor Giuliano Mirkamis, was killed by gunmen who objected to the theater's treatment of taboo subjects such as female sexuality and intra-Palestinian political rivalries. Nonetheless, the theater decided to carry on his work and are currently on tour here in Germany. Kate Laycock was at the Münster Pumpenhaus to see their first production since their founder's murder, Shokman, which means what else in Arabic.
Rehearsals with the Freedom Theatre are always full of energy and fun. For the seven young men on stage, however, participating in this production meant a difficult decision that could place them in danger. In April 2011, the founding director of the Freedom Theatre, Giuliano Meirhamis, was shot dead outside the theatre doors. The masked gunmen who waited for him are thought to have been inhabitants of the Jenin refugee camp who objected to the Freedom Theatre project. This group uses drama to examine not just the Israeli occupation, but social and sexual taboos in Palestinian society as well. Giuliano's name had been synonymous with the Freedom Theatre, and even after his death, his charismatic personality seems to be the driving force behind the group's work and their determination to continue. The Freedom Theatre has always been a family, explains director Nabil Al-Rai.
We always live together, we always work together, and this is very difficult for us because he was a leader and he was standing for something he believed in. And after that, we felt really what we can do for him first, and for the ideas, for the things that he believed in, is to continue the work, is to hold on, is to cut the tears and go on.
You can't have known Giuliano and not have come back, adds Nabil's co-director, Zoe Lafferty. The 25-year-old British director was personally recruited by Giuliano Meirhamis and also feels a deep sense of loyalty. 2 months after the assassination, she and Nabil hold themselves up inside the theatre to begin work on a new production, a play devised from and based on the experiences and memories, fears and hopes of its young cast.
We kind of just began with discussion with the students. Who are you? What do you want? Who do you feel you are? What's your dreams? What's your fears? What's your nightmares? And then just going from that.
Any play which uses the collective experience of young people from Jenin as its starting point is bound to be violent. In 2002, the camp became the scene of one of the bloodiest episodes in the Second Intifada, or Palestinian Uprising. 22-year-old Faisal Abu Al-Hajja was 13 at the time. His memories of what became known as the Battle of Jenin were crucial in shaping the play's opening scene, a wordless, slow-motion depiction of a city under attack. And it's not just the past which Faisal and his fellow actors tackle in Shukaman. In scene after scene, violence is seen spiralling down from the top to the bottom, from the oppressor to the oppressed. Loosely connected, without any clear characterization or plot, these scenes form a nightmarish mindscape in which fear and intimidation are as natural as breathing.
It's not just checkpoints, not just the wall, not just the fight. It's become from part from my life, part from my mental. If I want to do anything in Palestine, I must think checkpoints, Israeli army, tanks, what happened. For by the Freedom Theater, we can't give space to think out the army, to think for the future.
For the moment, Faisal's dreams are modest. I just want to be able to go to work and feel safe, he says. But then a shy smile spreads across his face. And maybe even to direct, he says. Yes, I'd like to be a director. Kate Laycock, Deutsche Welle Radio.
Germany has a new national youth ballet. 4 weeks ago, a group of eight young dancers aged between 18 and 23 took up work at the John Neumeier Ballet Center in Hamburg, which also happens to be the home of the Hamburg Ballet. The German National Youth Ballet is an elite ensemble that has, as Peter Timmermann discovered, set out to make a difference in the ballet world.
Good, okay, now we need to get into...
I'm Dan van den Acker. I'm 20 years old, and I'm from Holland.
I'm Gabriela Finardi from Brazil, and I'm 19 years old.
I'm Graham Furman. I'm from Canada, and I'm 20 years old.
Dan, Gabriela and Graham have studied ballet back home. Now their talent has taken them to Hamburg. For the next 2 years, the trio will be working in Germany's new National Youth Ballet, together with young colleagues from Japan, Switzerland, the United States and Germany. The new company provides a unique opportunity, says manager Lukas Onken.
In der Ausbildung der künstlerischen Persönlichkeit.
We help our dancers to develop their own artistic personality, and that's special. They learn the classical vocabulary, of course, but they dance together as an ensemble of equals. We don't have a principal or a prima ballerina, and from the beginning they also get the opportunity to work as choreographers, which is very unusual. So as a package of opportunities, our young dancers get an education that can be found nowhere else.
Eine extra Ausbildung, die man sonst nicht kriegen kann.
Dan and Gabriela know to be a dancer is very hard work, and every day you just want to be better than the day before.
We start in the bar, and then we do foot exercise to place our hips and stuff like this. And then we have plies, tendus, rond de jambe. And then we go to the center and we do pirouettes, like turning, and jumps.
We were given a piece of music to improvise to, and we were put on a stage with the audience all around us. And we interacted with each other, but there was nothing set beforehand. So that's one example of something that you wouldn't normally see in a dance performance, is a piece that's entirely made up on the spot.
20-year-old Robert Benet from Canada was invited to choreograph a piece for the National Youth Ballet. What does he teach young dancers? I asked him.
I think it's showing them that it's not just about bodies. It's showing them that it can make them feel something and make them feel emotions they wouldn't normally feel and create a cathartic experience for them.
And girls, out.
Germany's National Youth Ballet is a hard-working, open and very creative troupe that Graham Fuhrmann says have risen to a challenge.
One of the main focuses of the company is to do different things and to take dance where it wouldn't normally be and bring it to an audience that wouldn't normally see it.
Yeah, we thought of going to a prison, so it's a really scary, in a way, place that we could go. But I think it's nice if we give them the opportunity to see us dancing.
There are a lot of people that aren't in the position to go and out and see a ballet. Like, we were thinking of going to old people's homes to show ballet there.
It's some place you wouldn't normally get to perform, so you're forced to be more creative to create something that suits where it's being performed, that suits being seen so close up and in a space like that. And it's just an amazing opportunity to bring ballet to people instead of forcing them to come to us.
But also, I think the younger generation, if they didn't grow up with culture or ballet, they don't really have an idea about it, so we go to schools.
With their own repertoire, which creatively reflects the emotions and ideas of this ensemble, the National Youth Ballet is an ideal mediator between youth culture, high art, and the public. It also has a valuable social aspect with a positive effect on the non-dance world, says manager Lukas Onken.
Dadurch, dass diese jungen Tänzer mit ihrer Leidenschaft.
Because these young dancers approach dance with such passion and zeal, audiences will feel less inhibited to experience their innovative art. It'll touch new people, it can make them think, and it allows them to get in touch with their very intimate self. Dance brings people together. And that is our mission. We want to tie in with the successes of other junior companies and further increase the awareness of dance as an art from within our society. We go new ways, and we don't care about the rituals in theater.
Diese Rituale, Theater, wie man sich verhält, die sind uns nicht so wichtig. Wir konzentrieren uns auf den Tanz.
Peter Zimmermann, Deutsche Welle Radio, Hamburg.
That is all for this edition of Newslink. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I hope you'll join us again tomorrow. I'm Matt Herman. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the program. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.